Few films exemplify their era more than 1964's Mary Poppins, a treacly children's movie so full of iconic performances, songs, and sequences that it actually won 5 Oscars, famously winning Best Actress for Julie Andrews, already a legendary musical theater actor on her way to megastardom. Quite a coup. And on top of that, this film was the feather in the cap of Walt Disney himself, it coming at the end of his multi-decade quest to acquire the rights to the source material from its creator, P.L. Travers. All in all, Mary Poppins was an unmitigated triumph. Who could have possibly foreseen that this gigantic success would be one of the last classic films to look like this, sound like this, or star these kinds of people that anyone would ever want to see again? Welcome to Kale Your Idols, a new Hollywood podcast with your hosts, Elena Gibson and Sam Ludwig. So we're talking about the film Mary Poppins this week.
Yes, we are.
And why are we talking about Mary Poppins when we're supposed to be doing a new Hollywood podcast?
Well, I think one of the best ways to explain what new Hollywood is to first explain what old Hollywood is. And probably doesn't need a huge explanation, but we thought it'd be helpful to give an example. So our example for Old Hollywood Part 1 is Mary Poppins.
You're kind of looking at me like, are we about to say this in unison right now? Are we going to say Mary Poppins in unison? But I didn't pull the trigger on it. I could have made it happen. So but this isn't, we're probably going to do another Old Hollywood thing too, right? We're probably going to do a couple to set the scene?
Yes. So we thought at first it'd be good to do an Old Hollywood movie that was a success.
Yeah.
Kind of a quintessential old Hollywood.
In the 60s.
Right. We're not talking like 50s. It's pretty close to the new Hollywood era, yet it's still definitely an old Hollywood movie.
Yes, in many, many notable ways. It involves a number of sort of figures who I guess wouldn't make the transition really to new Hollywood.
Dick Van Dyke definitely is not a new Hollywood guy.
Nor is Julie Andrews. Nor is the director, Robert Stevenson.
No. Julie Andrews has succeeded in remaining a beloved person, but she's very much a beloved individual and not a edgy new Hollywood.
There was that movie where she was like, I have to take my top off in this movie. In the late 70s. Where she was like, I need to get more edge. And she was like, I need to be in one of these new Hollywood type movies. So a number of figures that didn't really transition to the new era, and we can talk about their careers individually to whatever degree we want, but I think, obviously, the one thing that we have to acknowledge has certainly persisted before, during, and after. I mean, weathered the major systemic changes of many seismic cultural events before and since is the Walt Disney Corporation.
Yes. Disney is one of the safest stocks to invest in.
Yes.
So says my dad.
Are you invested in Disney?
I think I have a little bit of money in Disney. I don't, that makes it sound like I've got a bunch of money in stocks. I probably have a total of $200 in stocks. But I was told Disney is a safe investment because it always creeps up.
And why, though? I mean, like, they do have these periods where they become a kind of a total joke. But they're just an incredibly malleable corporate identity, despite also having this brand that hasn't really changed. Like, it's not like Disney ever went R-rated or something.
Yeah, but I think that's why it's stood so well. It has such a foundation in being wholesome. And it's amazing that kids still want to go to Disney World and Disneyland.
Well, now it's certainly not just kids.
No, sure.
Like,
probably maybe even more popular amongst people my generation.
Right.
Than kids. Oh. Everybody wants to go to Harry Potter World.
No, I know. And the Star Wars thing? The new Star Wars exhibit? The Edge of the Galaxy?
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, it's a whole thing. They dress you up as a Padawan, give you a lightsaber, and reduce 30-year-olds to squealing youngsters. But people love it. Like, I mean, it was this highly anticipated premiere that had been years in the making. I remember people were talking about it all the time. And I mean, this is also a big controversy, of course, during COVID. Because we live in California, sort of near Disneyland-ish. So there was like a lot of people that we knew, I think, that were still desperate to get back into the park during the early days of COVID.
Yeah. I think their international presence is also a huge reason why they've been so successful now.
Yeah.
Well, pretty evil.
I feel like when I was a kid during the 90s, during the Disney Renaissance, it's weird. Well, we can get into a lot of things because this movie actually intersects quite heavily with my childhood in particular. But when I was a kid, Disney, it was like this thing that you just tolerated. You didn't really have an opinion about it. I don't think people like loved the Disney movies so much. Maybe kids did, but I don't feel like they loved them as much as they claimed that they loved them now.
No, I disagree with you 100%. I loved the Disney movies back in the day,
and I saw still them.
Love them. They're so nostalgic. I think they're great. Not all of them, of course, but like they have a really warm place in my heart, and I loved them when I was younger for sure.
I think I love the songs. The movies, sort of. Like I have an appreciation for the movies. I watched the movies. I as a kid, was always, like, I hated the kids' stuff as a kid. I was always interested in finding out what else there was. You're looking at me like I'm such a douchebag.
No, right? No. It's just like, I mean, Little Mermaid was so...
Well, yeah, good. See, Little Mermaid, I don't even think I really saw the Little Mermaid as a kid. It was, like, a little too early. Because I only think I saw the Disney things that, like, as they came out in theaters, in their moment... But
I never saw them in theaters.
That's right. You missed that.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at though is I feel like it was like a thing where it was popular, but it wasn't like it is now. I guess because now it's like literally the only thing that there is. I mean, they just buy up all these studios. Like we watched The Simpsons Mary Poppins episode after this, and we watched that on Disney Plus. But my point is, I think there was like a Gen X like, oh, Disney is so bullshit and treacly thing. And stuff that was, like, sort of the pushback that you could have in the 90s, where now it's just either you're with us or against us. It's, like, either you're a Disney person who, like, is totally on board with them taking over culture and loves what they've brought, or you're yucking everyone's yum.
I mean, franchises are so big right now, so I guess that's one thing that Disney really saw coming was the power of franchises, and they kind of built that in the world of movies. When prepping for this movie, we also watched Saving Mr. Banks. And I just think it's so messed up that that's a Walt Disney movie.
Yeah.
They make Disney seem like the best ever. Like, I know they make him seem a little hard-headed and stuff, but still, he comes out totally great. He's played by Tom Hanks, so of course he's going to come out great. And they make Mrs. Travers just seem like this sexless, kind of stupid, pig-headed woman who is really in need of therapy.
Totally.
And they make a big deal about how she was so protective over the script and the portrayal of Mary Poppins in the making of Mary Poppins. And it's like, you know that she would freaking hate the Saving Mr. Banks movie.
Probably.
And she would have never approved of it. And yet they made it, because they knew, like, oh, this will make money. This is some treacly shit. Like, they really did her dirty in that movie.
You're totally right.
I don't know too much about the rights in terms of her property. I know that she was very private with her own life. But I do know that towards the end of her life, she tried to sell a collection of her own personal papers, including letters that she wrote to Disney.
Yeah.
And nobody would buy them, and she ended up having to repackage them and sell them as a collection to just some library in Australia. So
God, when you're selling to a library, that's when you're really scraping the bottom of the barrel. What do they pay, $2?
I just think it's so sad that nobody cared enough.
No, it's true. You could say that it's a loving portrait, Saving Mr. Banks, in a way, but it's really not. It so clearly, like, sets her up as to be so critical that you can't help but be like, well, come on, the Disney movie's not that bad. They could have made that movie a little bit more harsh, you know, having Walt Disney be a bit more of a jerk. I think that they should have a certain amount of him turning on her at the end and being like, it's not your baby anymore, okay, Pamela? Which is what happened in real life, I think.
Yeah, she basically said you have to cut that penguin scene, and he's like, that ship has sailed.
Which
yeah.
would be crazy to cut the penguin scene.
No, it would be
considering
crazy,
the structure of the film.
And the penguin scene.
No, I know. It holds up. It's in the centerpiece of the middle of the movie.
I think she was wrong in her criticisms of the movie.
Okay, do you want to talk about our histories with Mary Poppins now?
Oh, sure. My history is short. I watched it as a kid, and I think I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And that's all I remember about it.
Yeah, so I didn't have a lot of memories about the movie until I rewatched it a couple of years ago. But when I was a kid, when I was like a little kid, this was apparently like the movie that I watched. Like, this is family lore. Everybody always talked about it. Was like, you would never fucking stop watching Mary Poppins all day long. And this, and they would tell me this, and I was like, I don't remember. I remember barely anything that happens in that movie.
Were they like trying to imply things about you that you?
No. It was literally just like, you know, oh my God, you made us watch that movie a million goddamn times. I've seen Mary Poppins so much, and I was like, I have no memory of that movie. I could watch it right now and probably it'd be like new. But what I vividly always remembered from the movie is like the Mr. Banks stuff. Like, I always remembered that ending scene where they punch through his hat and undo his umbrella and pull his pocket out and rip up his flower was just, that was seared in my memory. See, this is the thing, is I always liked the adult stuff. I was always like, what the hell is going on with this man's life? And that whole sequence is beautiful, too, by the way. The whole ending.
Yeah.
It's really memorable, I think. Obviously, I remembered the iconography of the penguins and the Mary dancing around, but like, I didn't remember what was going on in the movie. And yeah. I certainly don't remember why Mr. Banks had gotten to that place or what was going on.
That scene is definitely highly stylized. Like, they walk into a room and it's dark, but I think there's like a red
tons
light.
Of red.
It's like, why are they all there at 9 at night? Like, yeah. Is this all they do? These like old banker guys, this 9 at night, they're like having secret meetings about who they need to fire.
By the way, also, just can I quick run down, like, what, since neither one of us have read the books, and I think we had to talk about the books and, like, yeah. The differences in the portrayal and stuff like that, but can I just run through a couple of things that occur in the different Mary Poppins books, which are, like, 7?
Yes.
So, obviously, there's a tea party on the ceiling, as portrayed in the film, that's in the first book. Second book, there's a tea party that's upside down, and a circus in the sky. Third book, there's a garden party under the sea. And a tea party with the people who live under the dandelions.
This is a lot of tea parties.
It's all it is tea parties. This woman's imagination extends to, like, and then they go into a magical land where there's tea and crumpets or something. Like, it's, like, literally, but that's Alice in Wonderland, too. The English really do just center tea. That's, like, all you need to spark the imagination is a spot of tea and a dandelion.
But she was Australian and identified more as Irish.
Yeah, she identified more as Irish.
I think she described herself as, like, her birth was, like, misplaced, and she felt more Irish. There's that part in Saving Mr. Banks where he says that she has a Celtic soul just like him, but I read somewhere else that she felt like she should have been born in Ireland.
Hmm.
I don't know, but I think just because she loved her dad.
She wants to get kissed. She loved her dad, Colin Farrell.
She loved her dad, who was Irish.
Is that why they hired Colin Farrell?
Maybe.
He's Irish?
He's very charming. I'd hire Colin Farrell also. And he's good at buying a trunk.
He is. He does have that. He has that in his repertoire.
I mean, there is that Irish fox in the movie.
Yeah.
I'm guessing she didn't write that part since that was the animated part. Maybe it's in the books, but there is a weird part where this fox is getting chased in a fox hunt scene, and he's clearly Irish.
Yeah, you're right. That's, yeah.
And he's hunted by Englishmen wearing red coats.
Well, the perception of Englishness is interesting, obviously, in the film, because yes. It's made by Americans.
Yes.
And the Americanism pokes through in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, they make the British people seem so eccentric. Like, what the heck is going on with that house that's also a ship? Yeah. And there's, like, the crazy guy. It just...
Well, so is that about the waning British Empire or something like that? Like, I think that they're making a commentary on, like, this once great power that controlled the seas, and now they're, like, landlocked and just a bunch of old fools trying to keep their households in order.
That's a deep reading of it. All I know is I think they might have made some of their teeth look worse than they actually needed to be.
They did?
I don't know if they did on purpose, or maybe they actually just had bad teeth.
But. So, again, we watched this on Disney Plus, and I feel like, so I rewatched this movie about 7 years ago on Netflix, and, like, the most notable thing was that everyone looked as orange as a carrot in the movie. Like, the makeup looked atrocious. And I think it was, like, something about the HD on Netflix. Disney clearly had toned it down for this, and they looked very good, and it was nice and pale looking and stuff, and it didn't look garish. But it was, like, creepy looking when I saw it. So I was looking forward to that, I have to say. And the fact that we didn't get that was a little disappointing.
I'm sorry that they didn't look creepily orange.
Mr. Banks, looked so like a stage Gilbert and Sullivan actor. It was crazy. But anyway, do you know the film helped to fund the Disney monorail?
I didn't know that.
It went, a lot of the film's fundings went into helping the park.
Exactly what Mrs. Travers would have wanted.
Yeah.
It made her rich, though, too. She got like 5% of the gross sales.
Highest grossing film of the year.
I believe you. I know it made, I think, $103
million. Yeah, that sounds like a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
It won Julie Andrews Best Actress.
Yeah, it won 5 awards. Best Actress, Best Film Editing, which I agree with.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Best Special Effects. Agree with. Best music for original song and best music for original score.
All deserved.
Interesting to note, Mary Poppins Returns earned $349.5 million.
Not quite as much as a Disney movie should now.
Yeah, we didn't see it.
No, so. We didn't see it. We didn't even watch it in preparation for this. Interesting to note, obviously, also Julie Andrews passed over for the role that she originated in My Fair Lady, the film version, Audrey Hepburn cast instead of her. Dubbed over by Marnie Nixon, who I believe voiced all of the penguins or voiced several of like the animated characters. She voiced a lot. She dubbed a lot of Natalie Wood and West Side Story and stuff. But Audrey Hepburn not nominated for the Oscar that year.
Oh.
And Julie Andrews won.
Good for Julie in her Andrews.
First screen role. And spoiler alert, one of only a few.
It's weird that she wasn't in a lot of movies because she is so famous.
Yeah, she is the all-time person who's famous for 2 roles?
3. That, Princess Diaries.
That's a movie that she got because of who she is.
I know, but I'm just saying.
That's a movie that involves any watcher of that movie going, this is Julie Andrews that I'm watching.
Yeah, but she's great in it.
She is quite great in that. Some people also know that she was in Victor Victoria, but even I haven't seen that movie.
And he's seen a lot of movies.
And I've seen a lot of movies, and it's a musical. That's got a crazy premise. Anyways, Julie Andrews plays a governess in both roles, or a nanny in both of her famous roles.
She's different in both of them. Like, this one, she's, like, really stern, but loves the children and is magical. And in Sound of Music, she is not stern.
There's nothing mysterious about her in Sound of Music.
No. Whereas, she's just kind of carefree. And I mean, in both cases, she takes them on outings.
Yeah, she takes them on outings. She loves the outdoors. Sound of Music actually filmed outdoors, unlike Mary Poppins, which all soundstage.
Yeah, clearly and filmed on a set. Yeah, that right Hollywood. There, big difference between New Hollywood and Old Hollywood.
Yeah.
Definitely a studio film.
Yes, yes. And has that vibe in general. Just everything is so painterly and like artistically rendered and... There's just, like, this garishness to Disney movies. It's almost like those, like, Russian movies that, you know, I can't quite stand, except it's a little bit more pleasing to my palate than that.
Yeah. It's Technicolor.
Is that what that is? Is that what's bothering me?
I think you don't like Technicolor.
I think it was also something about, I'm telling you, like, I can't overstate the makeup. When I saw it the last time, it was really weird looking. Everybody looked so strange. And the other big thing that I noticed the last time that I watched the movie was that... It's a movie that wants to teach kids about what friends with benefits are.
So you mentioned this to me once before. You're convinced that Mary Poppins and Bert are fuck buddies.
You're not?
I mean, they clearly knew each other in the past. They're going to see each other again.
Yeah.
They look at each other fondly.
Mary acts like she's friend-zoning Bert, but it doesn't quite seem like she is. It's also just like very unclear. And this has to do with the push and pull of like, Travers wanted no hint of romance, and Disney wanted there to be a hint of a romance between the two of them. So I think it's left ambiguous in that way.
Yeah, I mean, Mary definitely seems like the kind of person where she makes things magical. She's down to do crazy shit. She just doesn't want you to, like, say that that's what's happening. She right. doesn't like him. She doesn't like Bert saying, oh, when you're with Mary, it's going to be an amazing time.
Yeah, she's not into labels.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, she said maybe fuck buddies is the wrong term. But no, it's like, you're right. Mary is exactly the person who, like, comes into your bedroom in the middle of the night, naked, and then is like, don't say anything to anybody about this.
Yeah, I get that vibe from her.
Yeah.
Now, it's weird because P.L. Travers didn't, like you said, didn't want there to be a romantic relationship between Mary and Bert. But it's not like... P.L. Travers didn't like a little bit of romance or eroticism. She used to write erotic poems.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I don't know how erotic they were, but she used to write.
Are they like magazine. British erotic where it's like, the crumpet crumbles from his lip, which hangs stiffly under his mustache.
I tried so hard to find an example. All I got was a quote. Here's a quote where she's inviting her readers to imagine her taking off her underwear. She says, "The silky hush of intimate things, fragrant with my fragrance, steals softly down, so loth to rob me of my last dear concealment."
Wow, that is some flowery stuff. And she's all like, "And you all know what I smell like."
Yeah.
She's like, "You know, it's got that special little Travers hint," which my readers all know.
Oh my God. So she's not a sexless person, which is something Saving Mr. Banks got a lot of criticism for.
She has some flirtatious moments with various people that don't seem to want to hook up
with her. I mean, they're very, like, minor. A lot of people believe that she was bisexual.
Right, right. I think I knew this, yeah.
And so people think that there should have been at least some mention of that in the movie.
Yeah, why didn't Disney put that in the movie? Why didn't Disney put that in a movie that it wants to sell to an international audience? So, anyways, Disney sucks in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Most ways. They suck, mostly. But this movie is, I think, good.
Me too. I think Mary Poppins is great.
I think it's pretty great.
And yeah. I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to pick it as Hold Hollywood is because it is... It's a great movie. It's successful.
It delivers on its treacly promise.
It's truly delightful.
Yeah.
It's feel good. That's a key old Hollywood thing. Now, okay, to be fair, when we were thinking about old Hollywood movies, there were a lot that came up that we nixed because they were a little too morally ambiguous, and we're like, okay, that's not a perfect example.
Too much like New Hollywood.
Yeah, because New Hollywood's morally ambiguous, so when we were thinking of what's a good example of old Hollywood, there are some that are, like, in between, you know?
Film noir. Evil's punished, usually.
Yeah, I think they still draw clear lines of what's good and bad. It's just they show the badness a bit more.
Film noir, it's usually kind of like, if you're a sucker, you get punished. If you're a fool enough to fall for this dame's line, you deserve whatever you're gonna get, you fool. But, right. So this movie, a little bit cleaner. The source material perhaps has a little bit more depth and ambiguity and strangeness at the heart of the central character, but the film does not.
Yeah. Mary Poppins, from what I understand, is much stricter in the books.
Yeah, much stricter is my understanding. Just basically not somebody who seems to show that they care a lot for children. It's that classic thing. Anybody who's ever hung out with kids knows that, like, kids love some older person who pretends to not like them.
Yeah.
But like, anytime, like, you're like, get away from me, I don't want to hang out with kids, but you can tell that they clearly are, like, a kid at heart.
Yeah.
Kids love those person. Yeah. Them. My aunt is just like that. It's the reverse psychology, I guess. But there's also this certain thing. I went down the rabbit hole of reading Jungian analysis and this deep unconscious reading of Mary Poppins, the character. Because she just sort of, like, puts you into this environment where she's then not going to explain anything to you. She's just sort of like, and we're going to this. And then you're like, whoa, that was crazy. What just happened? She's like, what are you talking about? That didn't happen. She doesn't want to contextualize anything, like, yeah, you're saying. Yeah. Like, she's just not interested in putting a name on anything. That it's just sort of a way of letting your subconscious come alive and figure out things for itself. There is no set moral. And there's no set lesson. It's just sort of like, what happens?
I read that in the first book, one of the first things that happens is she meets the kids, takes them up to their room, and immediately gives them medicine. Like, she's drugging them to listen to
Which
her.
Was a thing that they used to do to kids.
Yeah, they gave them alcohol if they were crying too much.
They did. I was hearing... And just to get them to sleep. Maybe we should bring it back.
I think you really hit on something. I think what's missing is drunk kids in our lives. I think that the world needs more drunk kids.
No. I don't want a drunk kid in my life. I want a kid drunk, locked away in their room so I don't have to deal with them.
Oh, okay. I got you now. Yeah, that's good, too. Yeah. I think my mom had given me brandy before when I've had an earache and couldn't fall asleep.
Just a snifter of brandy.
Just like a spoonful.
A spoonful of brandy.
I do want to say, she gives them all medicine, and it all tastes like different things to each person.
Right, right.
She gives herself rum punch flavored medicine, and then hiccups afterwards.
Yes.
Like a clear suggestion that she likes to tip the bottle a bit.
There's supposed to be a touch of danger to Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I mean, they show her magic going awry when they're cleaning the house, and then things just keep, like, opening and closing without her meaning to. This doesn't really come out anywhere else in the movie. Like, it seems like all the magic kind of works out throughout the rest of the movie, but there is this hint of, like, oh, this could be terrible.
Yeah, no, I mean, and they're always going and getting in scrapes. I guess, you know, like, Mary sort of takes over the whole sequence with the horses and just, like, wins that whole thing. But, like, the chimney thing, like, that's just them getting messy with the underclass.
You brought up Mary winning the horse thing.
Yeah.
I did want to talk about how self-involved she is.
That's supposed to be a bigger part of the character, I think, also, too, in the books.
Yeah, so I know P.L. Travers at one point, she calls Mary Poppins plain, vain, and incorruptible, which yeah. I think is, like, a cool description. I do think that it, like, she sounds like a cooler character in the books, and I think that's one of the reasons why her books were so critically acclaimed by adult authors
right.
also. T.S. Eliot, I think, really enjoyed the book.
It really does remind me of the thing that I was talking about with wanting to be a part of the adult world as a kid. I just have this vivid memory of, like, one time my brother was asked to take care of me, and he was a teenager. And we were walking around and his friends came and saw him and they were like, hey, come ride around with us. And now all of a sudden I'm in the teen world and I'm like yeah. a little kid. And they're talking about all this stuff and maybe they're talking about doing bad kid stuff or I have no idea what's going on. But you know what I mean? But it's like getting thrown into this sort of like alternate universe where it's sink or swim. But you're not, and there's nothing really being asked of you. It's just you're there as a sort of on a tour of the mysterious adult world where people don't quite say what they mean all the time.
The kids are just like hanging out while Bert and Mary are dancing around flirting with each other.
The kids run off, yeah. And, yeah. and then it's just like, oh, well, I guess we can have a moment to sort of like, been a minute, Mary. And it's Jolly Holiday with her. And, no, and that's the thing. That's a song about a manic pixie dream girl.
Yes.
Like, she is clearly a manic pixie dream girl to him.
Yes. Bert's magical. He knows that there's an audience watching the movie.
He knows there's an audience, and he can portend that Mary's coming. Like, he gets that sort of, like, ominous feeling at the beginning that Mary's coming to do harm, I guess.
And he also says that he thinks his handshakes are lucky.
No, no. Well, so that is actually a real thing. Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
So that's like a real thing. You would touch hands with a chimney sweep because they didn't live very long. Like, well, I'm not going to live very long, governor. Here, have a bit of my luck because I'm not going to use it.
Oh, my God.
It was like this super that's British, terrible. Super tragic custom.
The way that they portray poverty as such a cheerful thing is so messed up.
At the same time, though, interesting representation of poverty. Because I know that it's, you know, Travers obviously thought that the Bankses were being portrayed as too upper class in the movie.
Yeah, in her books, they were described as having the smallest house on the lane.
Yeah, and the father, you know, he is living on this precarious knife's edge. He's under the gun at work.
And he's supposed to be a bank clerk.
He's just a clerk.
He's supposed to be.
Okay. Yeah, no, so I think that there is this class consciousness. Well, the movie's portrayal of just anything political is so interesting. There's the suffragette-ness of Glynis Johns.
Oh, we're going to get into that.
Which we're going to get into. But just to touch on that, there's the brief moment where the chimney sweeps are all hanging out, and she comes in, and they're like, votes for women! Hop in time! Or whatever. And you're like, oh, it's like class solidarity with progress, right? Or something. But then they just get sheep led into saying something else. And it's like, oh, they didn't really think that anyway.
Yeah. They didn't seem to care that much about votes for women.
About being poor. Money is at such central part of
but
the
movie is like, don't worry about money. If you're poor, you're still going to be happy because you'll be a chimney sweep and look how happy they are. Or don't worry about right. money because you'll end up getting a promotion if you stop worrying about money.
Yeah.
Like in the end, the father gets fired, and then he gets a promotion to even a better job.
He shouldn't have been fired, though. They were wrong to fire him.
No, they were wrong to fire him, but
so he was right to get rehired. Like, he taught them the correct lesson. He taught them the lesson that they need to appreciate life a little bit more and not be dicks, which he was right
about. But I'm just saying, the movie is portraying poverty way too cheerfully.
Yes. No, it absolutely does. It just feels weird to have so much poverty on display in a kid's movie.
It's weird because you have to make it seem cheerful.
But, like, the movie's also about, like, this tuppence. They're so obsessed with the word tuppence. Like,
it's a fun word.
It's such a, like, Americans are like, tuppence. I love to say this word. Tuppence? Tuppence? Tuppence a bag. Like, they just can't stop what's this said. And then it all rests on the crucible of this tuppence here.
I did want to point out, so we have not watched Mary Poppins Returns. I did look up the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And What happens is, spoiler alert, the family, it's Michael, the son, who's now grown up, and he's facing financial ruin. He had to take out loans from the bank.
His wife's dead.
His wife's dead. He couldn't pay back the loans. And in the very end, what saves him is the Tuppins that he invested in the original movie have compounded interest.
Oh, so he was right to have invested?
Yes. And it saved him. Which is kind of messed up because they're like going against the original message of the movie.
Yeah.
I feel like they were like saying, listen, we recognize that the original movie said, don't worry about being financially responsible. And we realized you should probably worry a little bit.
Yeah.
But
it's like they brought in Jane Austen to write the new version or something.
It is crazy that like when we were watching the original Mary Poppins movie, they were saying, if you invest your tuppence, it'll have so many returns. And I was like, was it just that compound interest was, like, better back then?
Was it?
Like, could you make more money back then if you invested, like, two tuppence? And luckily there was an article written about this because of Mary Poppins Returns. If he'd invested two pennies over the course of 25 years, it would not have even returned a single pound.
Really?
Assuming average interest rates of 6%.
So they're still just piping bullshit into us. They're still pretending that they know the truth about how to be fiduciarily responsible.
Yeah. Like, they consulted with some financial guy about this, and the only way they could have made it work is if they invested in something really, really smart.
Like Disney.
Like Disney. Or like refrigerators or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then just before the Wall Street crash in the 1930s, they would have had to take the money out of the bank.
Right.
And into something like gold. And
the movie takes place in the 30s, right?
The original film was set in 1910. Yeah,
the new movie takes place during the Depression.
1935, yeah. So I think both the Mary Poppins and Mary Poppins Returns is a little confused about what it wants to say about being financially responsible.
Yeah, it's true. Travers said that Mary, there's the quote where like people say she represents like the magical nature behind everything or whatever. And Trevor's like, no, she represents everything. She represents like the real version of everything, like the grounded, like she represents actual reality, which is, I guess she meant by that, she means messy.
I guess so. I guess I can see that, but I don't know. I found it interesting when I was reading. So Travers was really into mythology and then became very spiritual later in life.
Right, right, right.
Like into Hinduism and Buddhism, and increasingly saw Mary Poppins as like the mother goddess.
Right, right. This Jungian analysis stuff makes sense.
She wasn't intentionally writing Mary Poppins that way, but then later realized like, oh, I wrote her like that.
It's like John Barth. Oh, you're telling me I wrote this Hero's Quest? But the impression that I'm getting of this like psychoanalysis like kind of take on Mary Poppins does seem like there's this great depth to the mysteriousness of the character, and it's hard for me to see because it's hinted at in the movie, and I can sort of envision this version of it in my head, but I do have a hard time imagining it still being like a quirky, cheerful thing and still being charmed every time they come upon a tea party in a new whimsical scenario.
I think I read that sometimes what happens in the books is like they get into these adventures as the kids are being punished for things, and then they are in, like, actually dangerous scenarios where Mary Poppins has to save them, but it's like she was just punishing them in the first place.
So is she, like, showing them that the world is a harsh and cruel place?
She's like this chaotic force. She's just fun.
Bird is right. Like, in the beginning, when there's something fucked up coming. Like, he senses in the wind, he's disorder and chaos is about to reign in the cherry tree lane or whatever.
I think that is the thing that makes her so cool.
And this is what, again, we haven't seen this, but Emily Blunt is supposedly doing more of the real Mary Poppins thing than Julie Andrews did.
I do think Julie Andrews is great.
Yeah, she's really good. I do. So, also, I wanted to mention, so in the movie, I was like, what's the deal with all these mirrors? And I guess that's just because Mary's vain, right?
Like, I think
they keep having a mirror.
Vain,
they keep having a mirror, like motif. I also wondered if in the books, if it's something where, like, does she like go through a mirror at some point? Mirror.
It is a good way of showing that she's got a bunch of stuff in her carpet bag,
right?
And also, it's a cool special effect.
Yeah,
but for sure, she's like looking at herself in the mirror and showing this other side of herself that likes to sing, like a little too over the top.
Yeah.
And cheeky.
Just a little too
showy.
She is a classy character in a weird way. Apparently the children were scandalized when they saw Julie Andrews smoking in costume and swearing swearing sailor with the
oh, like the kids on set?
Yeah.
But Julie Andrews has a less proper side.
God, what's his name? Christopher Plummer's quote about working with her during Sound of Music. He's like famously such a dick about it. But he was like, it was like getting hit in the head with a greeting card every day.
Oh my God.
I know, right?
What an asshole.
I know. Oh. It's a good line, though. If you're trying to insult Julie Andrews, that's a pretty good diss.
Yeah, that is a good diss.
That's a solid diss. Yeah.
I was reading this New Yorker article about P.L. Travers, and this one part I was like, what a dick thing to say. They were talking about how after the movie, she took up some jobs as like a residence writer at some colleges in the U.S., and
like a writer in residence?
Yeah, writer in residence, yeah.
It was like she's just writing sort of like clippings about the housing.
Sorry, go on. But they say that like she would like host these, oh, I actually don't know what this word is. Louche, L-O-U-C-H.
A louche at home. A louche at
home. Fancy lunch? I don't know. Whatever. She was hosting things at her dormitory apartment, and I'll quote, sprawling on the couch barefoot, clad in a loosely belted kimono, and coming to life only if a male student or professor wandered into the session. What a fucking dick thing to say.
So they were trying to have a hint of that in the movie, in Saving Mr. Banks, clearly. She was clearly, like, eyeing a lot of guys. Yes, obviously, that's a very dick thing that the guy... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to brush past it. That's an incredibly dickish thing to say.
Yeah, okay, she was described as a very flirtatious person.
Yeah. Again, doesn't come across in the movie enough.
No, does not come across in the movie enough. But, like... You can be a flirtatious person, but then to say that you only come to life around, like, a male student or professor walking into the room, that's just, like, fuck you, man. And, like, saying, like, clad in a loosely belted kimono, they're like, she's a fucking slut.
Yeah, no, you're right. That is just, total slut-shaming
and stuff. I was very put off.
Although, like, she's, like, an old lady, right?
Yeah, but good for her. Don't slut-shame no matter what they
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Do you think that there's any amount of, like... salaciousness, like, I think there's a certain amount of that kind of, like, Elaine Stritch, or, like, that sort of old-timey old lady who's, like, a real flirt that is sort of, like, people found it cute back then?
This person who wrote the New Yorker article didn't seem to find it cute.
Was it, like, an anti-P.L. Travers article?
It wasn't super anti, but that passage read is so anti. It just bothered me so much.
Clad in a loosely fitting kimono. And, like, she's just, like, belching and, like, why don't you come in and scratch mama's belly?
Yeah, and, like, just the idea of her, like, the imagery of her only coming to life when, like, the men walk in. I'm just imagining, like, what she'd be like when it's just the women, where, like, her eyes are glazed over and she's just, like...
staring off into space.
Yeah, and just, like, fantasizing.
I wish you were my nanny. Well, who would you rather have hung out with, Walt Disney or P.L. Travers?
P.L. Travers. She seemed more interesting.
Yeah, I think you're right. I also don't, I don't like what Walt Disney has created.
Yeah, like, he loves his freaking mouse and stuff, and the mouse is fine.
Yeah, just imagine just, like, living a life where you're constantly just, like, appraising your success, and then you turn over your left shoulder, and there's a picture of a fucking mouse that any 6-year-old could draw, and you're just like, that's my baby, right there.
No, like, okay, so I read about the premiere, which they showed a bit in the movie Saving Mr. Banks, but he had it orchestrated so that when he arrived, all of the Disney characters came, danced around the limo, and then as he stepped out of the limo, they released all these Mickey Mouse balloons up into the air.
Right.
Like, the man wanted to make himself a god.
He certainly did. Yeah, he created his own universe.
Yeah.
He is one of the first world builders. See, that's a person who it's like, I bet I would rather invite Disney to come somewhere and, like, just see the arrival and then hang out with P.L. Travers.
Yeah. That could be cool. Swap him out as soon as the arrival happens.
Yeah.
Did you know she had a son?
An adopted one, right?
An adopted son.
There's a lot of negativity around that, right?
Yeah, they weirdly hint at it in the movie Saving Mr. Banks. Somebody asks her, like, oh, do you have kids? And she says something like, not quite.
That's weird, right. Yeah.
Apparently, she first tried to adopt a 17-year-old girl who cleaned her house. But that didn't work out. The New Yorker article, they described that episode as bizarre, her trying to adopt the 17-year-old cleaning girl. But she ended up adopting a boy, W.B. Yeats, knew a family that I don't think they could afford to raise their sons, and so...
I only adopt the friends of poets. Like,
she really liked W.B. Yeats, so she adopted one of the twins. And
what?
Yeah. And she told the boy that she was his real mother. And I read two different sources. One, that the other twin showed up on their doorstep. The other source said that the one twin ran into his twin brother at a bar. But as soon as he realized that he had been adopted, that he had a twin, and that that twin grew up poor in
this is
Ireland.
Blood Brothers. Is this what Blood Brothers is based on? The musical?
I have no idea.
It's literally the plot of Blood Brothers.
Oh, wow.
Okay, sorry, go on. They're British and everything.
Who knew that P.L. Travers had such an effect on so many different pieces of
musicals? Yeah. Sorry, go on.
Apparently they had a very strained relationship ever since that became revealed.
He's just always looking at her a little funny.
Yeah. I mean, that is messed up to only adopt one twin. I mean, maybe the family wanted to keep the other twin. So some people call her a terrible mother.
Some people like her son.
I think that choosing not to tell your child that they're adopted doesn't make you a bad mother.
Choosing not to tell them that they're a twin.
I'm not going to pass judgments on P.L. Travers.
Why not? All right, that's fine. You feel like the movie, the Saving Mr. Banks, already did her dirty enough?
Yeah.
She does seem pretty cool.
Okay, actually, I'll throw some shade her way, or I don't want to make light of this by saying throw shade. Like, she wrote book reviews for an anti-Semitic British magazine in the far right.
Yeah, and some sort of racist caricatures within the Mary Poppins books.
Yeah, weirdly, I read that one passage that is overtly racist, and then she was forced to change it.
Yeah.
She changed the character to be an animal character instead.
Yeah, well, all of the different characters. It's called animals all over the world instead of people all over the world.
Okay, well, in the one thing in particular, she changed a black woman who was shown wearing very little clothing to be a parrot. That parrot character is in Mary Poppins Returns.
Really?
Yeah. So they got a lot of criticism for that.
Wow.
Like, why would you put that character in there? After making the revisions, she uses an offensive term, but she claims that black children read her books and love them. So.
Well, okay. Yeah, let's throw some shade at P.L. Travers, who seems just as racist as Walt Disney. Okay.
Let's talk about the morals of the movie. What's the message of the movie?
Well, so the movie shifts, and in fact, Saving Mr. Banks sort of portrays this effectively in a way where the movie shifts rather dramatically to being about Mr. Banks.
Yeah.
And it sort of starts getting hinted at about halfway through.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if in Saving Mr. Banks, it's like they realized halfway through the writing, oh, now we got our ending. And then they started changing it and making it being about that after originally thinking that it was about the kids. But, I once heard somebody, this music director I worked with, whose opinion I really respected, who'd come back from seeing the Broadway premiere of the musical, and he was so angry that they changed the ending song from Let's Go Fly a Kite, which I think was still in the show but maybe had a different position, to something else, something about Anything Can Happen, which is a song just about imagination or whatever, you know, Mary Poppins and stuff. Because he was like, it's the greatest ending ever, Let's Go Fly a Kite.
Yeah.
The parents gotta raise the kids, you know, they get, you know, it's so unexpected, but it's so correct, so earned and correct in a lot of ways.
Well, I know that Travers sold the rights to make a musical a couple years before she died, and she, I think, viewed it as the last chance for somebody to get it correct.
She wanted Sondheim to write the musical. I'm going to get in a little Sondheim history for here for a second.
Okay.
So Sondheim famously, in his developmental phase, was mentored by Oscar Hammerstein, the creator of basically the medium of musical theater, and he gave him a task of first adapting what Sondheim considered was a great play, like a dramatic work, into a musical. Then second, adapting a flawed play, fixing the flaws, and making it a musical. Third, adapting something that wasn't a dramatic form, like a book or a historical event or something. And then fourth, coming up with a completely original idea for his musicals. And the third thing, the adapted thing, was going to be Mary Poppins stories, because Sondheim loved those books. So he worked on them for years, and he said he could never crack it. Like, he could never figure out how to make it hang together and have a coherent theme, because they're so episodic and they're so mysterious, and there's something about the nature of the characters that is so British and wordy and not emotionally heartfelt that he didn't think it ultimately lended itself to a musical. And so that was actually the one project of the four that he didn't complete. So he didn't even finish that. And then years later, when he was contacted by P.L. Travers to do a new musical version, because she was so dissatisfied by the Disney version, he was like, no, I don't think it could be done, but also I already tried it, and I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do that again, you know?
Do you know what he thought about the movie musical?
No, he didn't say what he thought about the movie musical. But I would not be surprised if he agreed with her, with her assessment of it, given that he had tried to adapt the musical, and given the kind of writer that he is. I think that he also, maybe he could have done it if he tried, like, yeah, when he wasn't 16.
So you see the main message, and this is, I don't have much argument here, the main message being family.
Parents need to focus less on their concerns, hobbies, jobs, and more, not just on raising their kids, but on enjoying life themselves, too, and looking at life through the eyes of a child.
Yeah. Now, it's like he's able to do this because he gets fired.
Right. Yeah, only after losing everything.
Yeah. At first, when I was watching this, I was like, okay, they have this woman suffragette stuff, which they treat so lightly, and they have this female character who's like, votes for women, and she's like, we're going about it militantly, and it's like, but she's so frivolous about it. And it's
kind of incisive commentary on nowadays, on a lot of activism now.
Yeah, like, for sure. Like, I hate Insta posts about people attending rallies where it's like, you just wanted to post this picture.
The movie's definitely going hard on, like, she's not actually oppressed, right? That's, like, the message, is that she's, like, pretending to be oppressed.
Oh, I didn't think that.
No, it's like, she is this upper-class twit who has maids and shit like that, who, like, dress her and do whatever. And the bit, I think the bit is definitely, like, this lady is just looking for something to do.
Okay, I see that point, but we're talking at a time where they don't have the right to vote. And it's like, don't make it seem like such a silly thing to spend your time doing. And then with the, so at first I was like, oh, this is interesting that the only way things are changing in this family is the father has to lose his job.
Yeah.
And there has to be a breaking down of the patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
But then at the end, he gets a promotion. Right. And so then, now that we know, like, oh, okay, like, the parents have to raise the kids themselves. It can't be a nanny. That's what this movie's really about. The dad's still going to go back to work. So who's going to be raising the kid? It's going to be the mom who gave up her silly suffragette thing. She literally takes a suffragette banner,
ties it to the kite. Yeah, no, that's true.
And
uses
it as a toy.
That is so insane.
And she gives that up because she's like, this is what's really important is not trying to get women the right to vote. What's really important is raising my kids.
Oh, absolutely. No, it is a movie that is essentially anti-feminist, right?
Yeah.
Which is weird, because Mary Poppins is kind of the strong feminine character. I don't know about feminist, but she's certainly a working woman. I don't know.
I think where it's maybe some of this comes from is that Disney put in, according to Saving Mr. Banks, the mother being a suffragette because they needed to explain why she wasn't raising the kids herself, because she didn't have a job. And so I do think, yeah, the silliness, the frivolity of it all comes from the fact that, like, Disney put that in there to give her something to do, but P.L. Travers wrote the mom to be a bad mom. Like, the mom doesn't seem to care that much about the kids. Like, she's like, they're missing again! And she's only, like, really actually concerned about it when she realizes the dad's gonna find out. And then she's, like, scared that the dad's gonna find out that the kids are missing. And then, when Bert brings them home, she's like, oh, can you watch the kids? And she's never met
all of that is
Bert.
100% her fault.
Yeah.
Everything that happens there.
Yeah, like, she's never met Bert before. He's just this strange dude who shows up on the doorstep with the kids. He's got other shit to do, so she's super condescending about it. He, like, tries to say, like, I've got a job to go to. She's like, no, just watch the kids. And also clean our chimney. Presumably for free. I don't think she's gonna pay him for cleaning their chimney. But
I don't know. I assumed that she would pay him.
I don't know. There was no mention of that. And she's just she's a bad mother. And it kind of makes more sense when you watch Saving Mr. Banks, when you learn about Pale Travers' actual mother, but I think that the mother character is meant to be kind of a bad mother. Reminded me a lot, actually, of Nora in A Doll's House.
Yes, totally.
Because she acts like such a kid, and she treats the kids like playthings, except she doesn't have the strength and the interestingness of Nora's character to leave the kids.
Are you talking about the Glynis Johns in the movie, Mary Poppins, or the mother in Saving Mr. Banks?
In Mary Poppins.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I think also the creative choices are so, just look so bonkers from this day and age, but I really do think they're mostly utilitarian. Because it's just like, well, what could a woman be doing in Edwardian England? But I also think because they developed this focus on Mr. Banks, who I think does not get the focus in the books. Like, he is as distant a character as the mother. I don't think he ever takes on the narrative significance that the movie gives him. Mm. And so I think the mother comes off weirdly backburnered, in addition to being undermined as a feminist at every turn.
Yeah.
Played by Glynis Johns, the original Desiree Armfelt in A Little Night Music, another Sondheim connection.
Ooh.
And a pretty hot older lady.
She's got such an amazing, like, airy voice.
Oh, hello, children. She's just, like, so great. I love her. She's got such a randy voice. The movie is a kind of a horny movie. It's a movie that's got a real wink to it. It's a movie that really is trying to have a little something for parents and kids, even though it's relentlessly a kids' movie.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about some of the famous sequences from the film? Any musical number in this movie that's not sung by, like, the adults, like, by the parents or by the bank people or whatever, is, like, all-time great song. Like, in this movie, if it's a song that's being sung by Mary or Bert or the kids or something, anything that's not being sung by the parents or adults within the straight world, it's, like, the greatest song ever.
Now, I do think the bank songs, when he's trying to tell his son to invest, and then also when he's, like, saying what kind of nanny he wants, definitely not a memorable song. It's not going to stand out, but it is fun.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's pretty memorable.
But the structural aspect of it kind of saves it as being, like, kind of fun.
I know what you're talking about. I guess that it's got to be partially influenced by Julie Andrews, because that's all, like, this sort of, like, post-Lerner and Lowe, My Fair Lady speak singing kind of character. I'm sure they're just like, oh, we've got Julie Andrews in it, so she's got to have some guy who, like, says things like, I will sing, and then speak the last line. So we got to have some of that in the movie. And boy, do they. But other than that, like, the big famous songs, like, all the songs that, like, you've heard or can kind of envision or remember, they're all, like, super long. Like, all of the sequences are so long. The movie is long, too, in general. It's 2.5 hours. It's, like, the length of a stage musical. And all of the musical sequences are, like, almost 10 minutes long, I would say. But they each justify themselves because they're so well choreographed, like, second by second.
I love the choreography, for sure. I thought it was interesting that Disney was very much down to do a non-animated film for Mary Poppins because Travers didn't want it to be animated, and he was down for that because it happened around the time of the animator strike.
So yeah, he, right.
Like, needed non-animated movies. But no, I think that, like, the way they did the chalk scene felt like a different type of animation than his other movies.
Yeah.
And just so cool having animation and real people at the same time.
It comes off really great. Like, they do all the little tricks that they do.
Yeah.
They seem as well acted as somebody in a Marvel movie now.
Yeah.
Yeah, acting against nothing.
The special effects are very cool. Sometimes you can see an obvious outline around the characters when they're placed over top of a green screen.
Right.
And that took away from it a little bit. And the umbrella bird at the end was super creepy. With his
tongue. Oh my god, but if you are listening to this, you should go and just look at this online, find a thing of the umbrella bird talking, because he's got a movable tongue that's flapping. If you don't, maybe you vividly remember this is from your childhood or something, but he's just like, oh man, like, he just literally looks like he's somebody whose tongue is just flapping out of their mouth.
It's
every
so
word,
creepy.
Every syllable that they
it's
utter.
It's so creepy.
It's cool. I actually kind of like it. Oh, I think it's kind of fun.
I did not like that.
There's also a great part where they shoot Michael out of the chimney, and it's so obviously just like a soot-soaked dummy. And then it's just like, floop, and he comes out. And it's,
I was wondering, there was like this scene for the chimney sweeps where they're like dancing on top of the chimneys, and they're all like jumping around and stuff, and then they all jump into the chimney at once, and then they all jump out immediately afterwards. And I was like, was there just a trampoline down there? Did they like, how? I was kind of wondering how they did it. I don't know. It was cool. was
that
cool.
Joel Chimney scene is great.
The dancing is amazing.
Dick Van Dyke is great.
He's such a good physical actor. Yeah. He's so fun.
Love him.
I often don't like physical comedic actors because they're often very goofy. And yeah. I don't like goofiness.
He has a certain amount of, like, real personness.
Yeah. I mean, he's charming. And even when he's being silly, like, I'm thinking about, like, the scene, the laughing scene where they visit Uncle Albert and he's laughing so much and, like, going up on the ceiling. And then at the very end, him and Bert together crying. And Bert's face when he's crying is so over the top. But it's just, I don't know, it's super charming. And I just love the idea of, like, these two men and they just love to laugh.
I gotta say, that guy finds too many things funny. He's, like, finding everything funny. Like, I mean, at a certain point, it's like, I'm just like, okay, like, I get enjoying a good laughter, but I feel like you're just taking it to the extreme, and, like, this is why you can't really enjoy anything really funny, right?
But everybody knows sometimes you get in the zone of laughing where it's just yeah. everything makes you want to laugh.
I think there's something in the books that it's about, like, if his birthday falls on the third Friday of every month, then when he laughs, it goes, see, there's all this, like, weird lunar cycle or, like, cyclical stuff happening in the books, I think, where, like, oh, it is the day of the full moon on this thing, so that means Mary is now going to have a tea party under a bus or something, you know, like...
I mean, that's fun and witchy. I was annoyed when she tries to convince the kids that cleaning is fun. And it's like, well, of course you think that, because you can snap your fingers and everything just goes into the places they're supposed
to. So can they, yeah, you see, so the spoonful of sugar, right? There's, so there's obviously, like, two sides to this. It's, like, sort of part insidious message, like enjoy your work, peons. But also, it's true. And it sort of is speaking to that thing of, like, you know, in every task, there's an element of fun that you can just sort of, like, zone in on something and it feels like a snap, sort of.
I think Spoonful of Sugar is one of the messages of this movie that applies to old Hollywood in general.
Mm.
Mm. So I think that this is the perfect example of what old Hollywood is. Okay. A Spoonful of Sugar is a feel-good movie. Like Mary Poppins.
But is it medicine?
The medicine is living. So in order to take your medicine, in order to live and suffer the human condition, sometimes you just need some happy movies. And when you go to the movies, you need to be distracted. You want stories. Old Hollywood, it's the sugar to make you enjoy life.
Two world wars, Great Depression. But, like, these people had lived through some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Like, truly horrific things.
Yeah.
So, but then that raises the question, like, New Hollywood.
Right.
Post-60s, post-68 and stuff. America's reeling then, too. Is that this kind of new way of repackaging propaganda to people and saying, like, now they need to feel like they're, like, tasting something real or dark, and that's the only way that they'll be able to process this insane life, is if they feel like their movies are saying something real?
It's a super interesting question, because you feel like shit watching new Hollywood movies often. Like, they're good movies, but they...
Do they actually depress you?
Sometimes, but you know,
I think it is cathartic. I think it actually is what you want, like where you want those stories to go. And so it's satisfying.
I think it's depressing, but I think when you're depressed, you want to watch depressing stuff. And I don't think that necessarily is good for you, but I can tell you that what isn't good for you is to watch something that's too happy.
It's stupid.
That doesn't affect what it's trying to achieve. When you're watching something that's trying to be super cheerful and that's not how you feel and it's not working on you.
Yeah.
Then that, I think, is even worse than watching something that is depressing, like a lot of new Hollywood movies are. I think the issue is that people were watching these old Hollywood movies and they weren't working the way they used to.
Well, eventually, after this. Like, this one worked.
This one worked, yeah.
People said, give me more of that.
Maybe
Peele Travers said no.
Yeah, maybe what it really was the quality. Like, if they kept making things like Mary Poppins, maybe old Hollywood wouldn't have died because the magic would have kept working.
So, Walt Disney dies shortly after this. This is widely considered the crowning achievement of his live-action career. And one of the crowning achievements of him personally, because the movie, he took 20 years to try and get the rights. It was something he wanted. The director of this movie, Robert Stevenson. So, this is a guy, a journeyman director, who I guess probably Mary Poppins is also his biggest thing. Although he directed a lot of other movies that are sort of similar to this, a kind of live action Disney era thing. He made Johnny Tremaine. Did you watch that?
No.
Old Yeller.
Oh, I've seen that.
Right, Old Yeller. He did the original Absent-Minded Professor, Flubber, the original Flubber. There was a series of Disney movies that were filmed on this college campus, so they had like a bunch of collegiate movies, like The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes and Absent-Minded Professor and The Son of Flubber. He also made That Darn Cat, The Love Bug, Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Herbie Rides Again. Right, so it's like, I think we can see the movies becoming crap just through that sort of like career.
Yeah.
Right? It's like Old Yeller, aw, Mary Poppins, aw, you know, and it's just like, and then it gets sillier and sillier, and like The Love Bug. It's a movie I haven't seen, but you look at the poster and it just screams out of touch despite being a huge hit. You know what I mean? It's this movie that's like not trying to really engage with the 60s, starring Dean Jones, later to become the first Bobby and Company. Musical by Sondheim. And so, yeah, I just think that, like, Stevenson, and he made The Shaggy Dog, too. Just these, like, silly high-concept movies. Like, I guess you could argue that one thing that changed was America sort of growing up. Like, you know, we started having this baby boom, and then all of a sudden, now they're not kids anymore. And they don't want to see these four-quadrant kids movies. They want to see some new Hollywood movies.
Yeah, from what I've read, teens wanting to see movies and wanting to see cool movies is one of the drivers.
And now it's the opposite. Eventually, like, there will be no movies that are trying to appeal to, like, all these different age groups. It's just the same thing will appeal to every age group, every age kind of person.
I don't think young people watch movies. More and more frequently, I meet younger people who, they don't like watching movies.
No,
too long.
That's true. For them. And yet they'll watch a TV show.
Or they'll watch TikTok videos for 4 hours.
Right, exactly. These damn kids.
Another weird thing about the old Hollywood versus new Hollywood is, like, new Hollywood is still made by the studios. I think it's strange to be making these countercultural movies, but being funded by mainstream studios.
Maybe this is really, like, the hinge point where everything got all messed up culturally, except for the Grateful Dead, of course. Irony becomes commodified. Things like the end of Mad Men, speaking truth to power, becomes cool and becomes something that you can have a relatable protagonist in a movie do or something, you know? So maybe it was bad that movies have ever been given reason to see themselves as progressive forces or anti-authoritarian forces.
I think the issue is just who's making the movies and who's funding them, and that the movies are just so stuck in a money-making system. And we're going to talk about the new wave film movements.
Yeah.
And in those cases, the government is like, okay, artists, make some movies, do artistic things.
I think the old studios were a little bit more like that than Disney now, or like Netflix is now. Those people got in the movie business because they wanted to make cool movies as well as make money.
I agree. But I think that the problem is that's not sustainable once you start making money and then you're like, well, how do we keep increasing our profits?
Right.
It's like the capitalism.
The corporate thing where the board says you're out when suddenly your thing stops being formulaic enough to work or whatever. Yeah. They should just put us in charge because we clearly get it.
Yeah.
Fully.
Yeah. We should be in charge of all art.
We should. All commercial art, at least. Can I read just this short passage from this essay about deep unconscious thinking and Jungian thinking? It was a super dorky essay, I have to say. This person wrote, they were clearly just like, kind of person who was just a total bookworm, who was also now a psychologist. But I just wanted to read this passage because I think it's great. There were a lot of pearls of wisdom that made me want to read the books even more, which is, Mary Poppins is perceived as a confident authoritarian who knows all, yet she introduces the children to experiences beyond their comprehension without offering any explanations, interpretations, or confirmation that they even took place at all.
She treats the kids as intelligent creatures. And I think I like that approach. I think go ahead and introduce kids to a variety of experiences. And it's better to try and see what they think about it than telling them what to think about it. I don't think she leaves much space for them to have conversations about what they think about it. She'd probably want to be like, well, don't overanalyze it or something like that.
That's true.
But I like that she respects them as people who can decide for themselves what to take from it and what not to take from it.
Yeah, I like the touch at the end where you can tell that there's a certain amount of Mary's personal psychology that is at play. how she is putting on this brave front, but she knows she has to leave the kids. But at the same time, you get the impression where she just doesn't quite know how to handle,
yeah,
like
she can't
separation. She doesn't know how to handle emotions,
yeah,
of any kind,
yeah,
and that this is a failing of hers, I guess,
yeah,
and that is a failing that is not had by the rest of the Banks. The Banks do have a more coherent emotional life, yeah, at the end than Mary does.
It's true,
and even Bert. That's what, so. Yeah. Mary disappears for like a half hour within the movie.
Yeah, it's true.
It just becomes Bert. He gives the advice to Mr. Banks. He takes care of the kids. The whole chimney... Sorry.
No, I mean, this was going to be, like, my final question for the podcast, for this episode. They set it up as, like, she has a day off. There's all, like, it's always Tuesdays or whatever day, right, it is, where it's her day off. And I think that's the scene where she disappears for a while. It's, like, it's her day off. Now, she later comes and finds them, yeah, and with the chimney sweeps, and she's like, okay, I'll hang out with you. But, like, I really just want to know, what was Mary planning on doing for her day off?
What if a day for her is 1,000 years? So she just...
She's got, like, a whole other family to take care,
yeah,
of.
Yeah, right. She's got a whole family. She's got an adopted son.
Yeah.
And a twin. And he has a twin that she has to go be the nanny for, but not tell that she's his mother. But, yeah. The movie has a lot of moments of characters being like, I'm going to go do my own thing. For now, you know, just like, I think it'd be nice if we had some alone time for a little bit.
That's so healthy.
It is. It's very healthy.
She's but boundary setting.
No, she is. Well, no, she is. Right. Bert's not. Like, Bert has this intimate relationship with the audience and with everybody.
And he gets convinced to watch the kids, even though he's like, I really can't.
Right. Well, yeah, Bert is also so interesting. You think of Bert and you're like, he's a chimney sweep, but that's just like one of his jobs. Like, that seems like something that he just does sometimes.
Yeah, he said, like, today, right, I'm a chimney sweep.
Yeah.
He's like one of those guys who's just always got some new scheme and is never really succeeding at making money. But he doesn't seem to care that much. Like, he recognizes that he needs to make money.
He seems like a happier person than Mary.
He's more emotionally intelligent than she is, it seems, because like he is the one who explains to the kids the difficulties of their father. Like, right, he's the one who seems the most empathetic, even though she is doing stuff where you kind of understand, like, oh, this is going to help the father too. Bert is the one who like lays it out for the kids and who like states explicitly empathy for the father.
Yes. Yeah, and I feel like he also has that same for Mary, too. Like, I feel like he's also understands whatever she's got going on is sort of beyond him, but he is also a part of it. Like, because he's a part of this magical universe, even if he doesn't have magic. So it's like, he knows the guy who laughs on the ceiling.
Yeah,
like,
right.
He's, like, in her
crew. He was
crew,
there first, yeah.
Right?
So. And the kind of, I think they hint he's known Mary since he was a lad, because he says when he was a lad, I don't know, he didn't do well in school or something like that, and then she taught him supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Yeah, it's not all she taught him. But, you know,
And again, like, just the fact that he breaks the fourth wall does imply he's in the know.
Right. Well, so what is Mary's relationship to God? Doesn't she have this weird moment?
When she's singing about the bird lady, yeah, she talks about the saints of the cathedral looking down. And then when Mr. Banks is
walking, she's sort of Wiccan.
Right. And P.L. Travers subconsciously wrote her as this goddess figure. Where Bert is kind of like, he like worships her.
Right. Yes.
As do all of the animated characters. It is a weird thing to throw in the religious overtones when she seems like part of a completely different type of god goddess.
Might be setup. A kind of the Americanness creeping in a weird way.
Also, just like Disney's touch.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean by Americanness,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
There's the touches of cheeriness, like just like the non-Britishness. Because, you know, Travers explicitly stated that she did not want to have any American people handling it ever, like any adaptation ever again, which I think she broke that. But. Because I can see that. Because, like, there is a certain amount of, you know, obviously Dick Van Dyke's accent,
yeah,
famously horrible. But also just, like, things like adding in the religion and the cheerfulness and the politics. So, yeah, that's basically Mary Poppins. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, like, Spoonful of Sugar, Old Hollywood...
These were some things we said. Yes, somebody yes. make something out of that. I think it's an awesome movie. Obviously, I was obsessed with it as a kid. I had some kind of connection to it. I then had no relationship to it. The last time that I saw it, I thought it was kind of a boring movie and looked really ugly because I thought that transfer was terrible. And I was obsessed with how horny the movie was.
course you were.
Because I myself was very horny, and probably at the time. But this time I have to say, yeah, I think it's a movie that there's kind of never a dull moment.
Yeah, all the songs are so good. The dancing's so good.
No, like any given thing that you're watching, like you're watching with the knowledge that this is as good as this fucking silly ass movie could be.
They could fix the suffragette shit.
Yes, I suppose that. Yeah. Would you cut that entirely? Would you just cut that stuff? How would you do that?
They could have not had her give that up in the end or imply that she's giving it up at the very least, or they could have cut it. I think the movie's great, and I wish I would know what my experience would have been like transitioning from old Hollywood movies, which I love. I love watching old Hollywood movies. I love watching like sweeping romantic epics, mm-hmm. and you know, I love that. And I hope that I would have appreciated the coolness of New Hollywood at the time. Like, I love both of them. I think that New Hollywood needed to happen.
Needs to happen again.
And it needs to happen again. Let's stop the franchise shit. Let's get some interesting movies out there again. But yeah, I do have... I guess it's lame that I have a warm place in my heart for the successful, quality old Hollywood.
Same. In my opinion, one of the greatest film adaptations of a stage musical is How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which I think would be a lot of people's example of old Hollywood not working. I think that movie was like not a big hit and stuff. And so there's movies I'm curious to rewatch, like Dr. Dolittle. I think Hello, Dolly is a pretty bad movie. I have seen that.
Yeah, I don't like that musical.
I don't like the musical. I don't like the movie either. But I do think that I have a soft spot even for a lot of the things that people were getting tired of at that time. So I like it all, I guess. I like it all. I just like it when they change and we have different kinds of things.
Yes.
And not the same movie every 3 months. Yeah. Every year for 15 years.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah, we're not bitter at all.
So next week, are we doing another...
Next week, we're going to do another old Hollywood, but we will do one that is not as successful and that kind of illustrates why things started to change.
Yeah.
So tune in.
Yeah. It'll be something as mysterious as old Dame Poppins herself.
All right, that's our show. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Check us out on social media. Thank you to The Illuminator for our artwork. And remember, guys, we're a new podcast, so if you could leave a comment or just a like, that would really help us out. Thank you. Bye.